The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode of the Lawfare podcast is supported by the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. Law school that fits your life. Full-time, part-time, online, and in person. Learn more at mitchellhamlin.edu. That's mitchellhamlin.edu.
There's nothing inevitable about Trump, but the conditions were ripe for a demagogue. The Republican establishment had done a really bad job, you know, running the country. Under Bush, the country entered into this ruinous war with Iraq, which was really just a war of choice. And then the financial crisis. I don't think the financial crisis was entirely the fault of the Republicans, and certainly not Bush. It was just he inherited the system we had. But certainly people were very unhappy by 2016 with the lingering effects of an enormous recession, financial crisis, military defeat, and so on. And so, you know, when the elites in power have done a bad job, that's the chance for the demagogue to come in and say the elites are corrupt.
I'm Jack Goldsmith, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 29th, 2020. Last week, I sat down with Eric Posner, the Kirkland & Ellis Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, who is the author of the new book, Demagogue's Playbook, The Battle for American Democracy from the Founders to Trump. We discussed why demagogues are a characteristic threat in democracies, how the founders of the U.S. Constitution tried to ensure elite control and prevent a demagogue from becoming president, how these safeguards weakened over time, and how Donald Trump's demagoguery helped him win election as president. We also explored how Posner's perception of Trump as a threat to American democracy fits with his writings in support of a powerful presidency. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 29th, Eric Posner on the Demagogue's Playbook. So Eric, at the beginning of your book, you talk about receiving a phone call from a reporter the day after Trump was elected, and the reporter asked you whether Trump was going to become a dictator, and you thought that was an overreaction, you say in the book. And I think this book is about explaining why the frequent discussion of Trump as authoritarian is misplaced, and he should instead be seen through the lens of a demagogue. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I think there's a bit of a tendency to draw on examples from foreign countries like Weimar Germany or Hungary today, when we should be evaluating Trump and thinking about him from the perspective of American history and American institutions.
So you have a nice chapter about how the framers worried a lot about a demagogue. Why don't you tell us, first of all, you have a nice definition of what a demagogue is. So tell us what a demagogue is, why it's a danger to democracies generally, and what the framers, how the framers designed institutions to deal with it.
Sure. So the framers were highly educated people who drew on history, including classical history, when thinking about how to design American institutions. In ancient Greece and ancient Rome, which provided the best examples of limited government in history, with the possible exception of Great Britain, there was a recurrent problem, the problem of the demagogue. And so the problem was, in these places where there was either a democracy or a great deal of self-government or involvement of the people in rule, what would happen periodically is that a prominent person would gain power, usually by appealing to fear and prejudice and greed, and by promising to tear down existing institutions so as to generate wealth and power for ordinary people. This happened over and over again. And these people, these demagogues, they would often obtain power in this way. But once in power, they would engage in destructive behavior. They would sometimes become dictators or autocrats, or they might embroil the country in ruinous wars or civil war. And the founders were quite worried about this because they were trying to create a limited government, partly on the model of the societies in ancient Greece and Rome. And they didn't want this to happen in the United States either. So to try to address the risk of a demagogue, they tried to design institutions so that this sort of thing wouldn't happen. And as well known, the founders weren't really Democrats in the modern sense. They believed the people should be heavily involved in government in the sense of selecting government officials, either directly or indirectly. But because they worried that the people could be swayed by a demagogue, they put into place all kinds of institutions that would limit the ability of ordinary people to influence the selection of the sort of person who might turn out to be a demagogue.
Just run through the list, if you don't mind. In the Constitution, many of which, one of the themes of your book is, have dissipated.
Yes, exactly. They did a lot. And, you know, what we can divide what they did into two general categories. And I'll just sketch this out briefly. I mean, one thing they did is they limited the influence of ordinary people on the selection of government officials. So ordinary people could directly vote for members of the House of Representatives, but the senators were selected by the states, and the president was selected by electors who were individuals who were in turn elected by the ordinary people. But the hope was that ordinary people would select wise local notables to be the electors so that a good president would be chosen. At the time, there were also limits on the franchise so that most voters would be relatively educated people with a stake in society. So one thing they did was simply limited the influence of ordinary people on political outcomes. And then the other thing is related to the presidency. You know, this was they were worried that the president might be too powerful. And they were worried that a popular demagogue could become a president despite these other constraints. So there were historical examples, for example, Cromwell, and then shortly after the revolution in the United States, you'd get Napoleon in France. So, and what they did, of course, as is well known, is rather than create a king, or, you know, kind of a single, a government that's simply headed by one person, they created a government that was that consisted of three branches that would check themselves. So to some extent, the president, if it turned out that he was a demagogue, he would be checked by Congress and by the courts.
And by the states, I assume, also.
And by the states, exactly. Yeah.
So, okay, before I ask you how this worked out, I just want to get some definitions on the table, because part of the aim of the book, I think one of the main aims of the book, is to establish the demagogue as a real political category and to talk about its relationship to populism. So you have a wonderful definition of the demagogue, and I'm just going to read it. It's a couple of sentences long. Demagogue refers to a charismatic, amoral person who obtains the support of the people through dishonesty, emotional manipulation, and the exploitation of social division, who targets the political elites, blaming them for everything that has gone wrong, and who tries to destroy institutions, legal, political, religious, social, and other sources of power that stand in their way. The demagogue is frequently considered to be, and in many cases actually is, crude, vulgar, and violent, contemptuous of manners, civility, and norms, which the demagogue sees as structures that keep the elites in power. So that is pretty much a perfect definition of Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, that's just a coincidence. I wasn't thinking about him.
No, I know. I'm sure you weren't thinking about him. No, but seriously, so this is a real category that you identified prior to the founding and that the framers, as you just said, were worried about. So they set up these institutions, and the first demagogue, you have a chapter called The First Demagogue, and it's about Andrew Jackson, who's often been called a populist and sometimes, I guess, a demagogue. So why was he a demagogue, and why was he allowed to come to power given these structures that the framers had in place? Was it just a failure of institutions?
Yeah, well, the framers were brilliant people, or at least some of them were, but the institutional structures that they put up to prevent demagoguery began to fall apart almost immediately. And the fact is that America was a very democratic place in a kind of a sociological sense, and it increasingly was over the course of the early 19th century. Ordinary people wanted influence. During the revolution, the leaders of the country said that, you know, that appealed to popular sovereignty. The problem with the British was that they were suppressing the people. And so we throw off the British yoke and the people will have power. And Americans took that idea seriously. So when the founders created these institutions that ensured that basically wealthier people and elites would hold most political power, not all, but most, ordinary people were upset about that. And really, from a very early stage, even Jefferson attacked this idea of elite rule. And so very quickly, for example, the franchise expanded in the various states. That was a matter of state law. The states determined who could vote, even in federal elections. So more and more people were able to vote, at least initially. And people were increasingly looking for leaders who seemed like them, who seemed to understand their values and interests. Now, Andrew Jackson was a great general. He won the Battle of New Orleans, saving America from a kind of humiliating settlement in the War of 1812. And he became immensely popular. And, you know, he very much reflected the kind of classical demagogue. A lot of those guys, like Julius Caesar, for example, became famous and popular among ordinary people because of their great military victories. And Jackson took advantage of his fame among ordinary people to and gain political power in that way. And one of Jackson's arguments was that the existing political establishment was corrupt, the classic argument of a demagogue, and that the elites were trying to suppress ordinary people. And Jackson himself could point to, you know, the corrupt bargain, the so-called corrupt bargain, where he was deprived of the presidency in his first attempt. And so he and his allies, you know, waved the flag of corruption. And in that way, he was able to obtain the presidency in 1828, and he took office in 1829. He was a demagogue in several ways. In terms of the personality, he was a kind of a violent person. He fought duels. He wasn't, you know, out of control the way Trump sometimes seems. Jackson was famous for using his temper to terrify people, but he did control it. He was contemptuous of many different groups of people, African Americans. He owned slaves, of course, American Indians, who as president he would, you know, drive out of much of the South. And he was a kind of an aggressive person. So he criticized the establishment, and once he got power, he attacked all kinds of important American institutions.
But I think one of the themes was that in the end he established a new kind of elite. And also that he didn't actually, or maybe I'm getting this wrong, but he didn't actually end up having great policies for the common people, economic policies. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So he, and I think this is very important. So he goes to he 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 achieves power as a man of the people, and he, you know, he's not really very clear about what he's going to do for the people, but his surrogates, as we say now, made it clear generally that he would serve the public interest. He gets into power, though. It's not immediately clear, you know, what he's going to do to help the public. What he ends up doing is he is going after the Bank of the United States, which reflect a kind of personal animosity toward banks in general. It wasn't, interestingly, a really politically popular move, but he just, that's what he wanted to do. He did, of course, have allies, including, you know, small banks, small local banks that wanted the business of the Bank of the United States. The Bank of the United States was an elite institution. You know, people were suspicious of it. It did have a lot of power. In earlier years, it had been mismanaged, but it was actually very successful and very well run. And Jackson destroyed it. But I think he destroyed it. You know, he destroyed it because that's what he wanted to do. It wasn't really something that he thought would enhance his political power. The other thing he did, I think, his other main, you know, negative accomplishment was that he what people often say is he introduced the spoil system. The more accurate way of putting it is that he basically corrupted the federal bureaucracy by making bureaucrats more dependent on the favor of the president. The new strategy for a president to get power, starting with Jackson, was to promise his supporters offices once he got into power. And that basically guarantees a mediocre, corrupt bureaucracy. So he didn't really do a lot for ordinary people in this sense. Now, he did have other accomplishments. So, for example, he did handle adroitly the nullification crisis when South Carolina basically, you know, refused to respect federal law. And so he certainly wasn't incompetent or stupid. You know, he was able to do some good things. One of his other major accomplishments, if you want to call it that, was the removal of Indians. This, of course, is now thought of as a terrible thing, which it was in an objective moral sense. At the time, you know, it was definitely controversial, but in doing that, he had a lot of support of white Americans. So I think from the standpoint of the time, he was implementing a controversial policy that had a lot of support, and the people who were in favor of Indian removal were grateful to Jackson for doing this. That said, it was a kind of a precursor to Stalin and people like that, so hardly admirable. But what I want to say, just to answer your question, is that in terms of advancing the public interest as understood in the time, you know, he was at best a mediocre president. He did okay, but his more important legacies were his attacks on important institutions, the federal bureaucracy, and the bank, and that was highly destructive for the well-being of ordinary people for many decades to come.
So I guess for me, one of the puzzles of the demagogue is, as you describe it, maybe there are exceptions outside the American context, but in the American context, they run against institutions, they run against elites, they run on behalf of the people, they use dishonesty as characteristically to achieve these ends. But then they get in power, and why do we not see examples of politicians responding to that set of problems, which you describe as... You know, you describe in the book that elite rule has always been a problem and a challenge for the American democracy, and that frequently politicians run against it. I guess why don't we see more successful demagogues is what I'm asking. Why aren't they better at fixing the problems that they come in promising to fix?
Because the goal of the demagogue, which is to attack and destroy elite institutions, is inconsistent with the functioning of a democracy, which depends on elite institutions. That's the basic paradox. And you had asked me earlier, didn't I say that Andrew Jackson had created a new set of elites? And let me answer this question by going back to that. So what Jackson does, you know, is he gets to power attacking the elites. But Jackson, you know, as president, he's just one guy. He needs people to help him. He needs allies. And so a new set of people, the people who help him into power, and then opportunistic people after he gets into power, become the elites. They offer him support, and in return, he gives them privileges and offices and so forth. A lot of these elites were military, for example. Other elites were sort of, you know, local elites rather than national elites in Washington. So you had a new set of people, professional politicians, the sort of people who would broker conventions, prominent newspaper editors and journalists, you know, a whole group of new people. And this group of people replaced the earlier elite, which was, you know, basically Virginia planters and Northeastern merchants and people like that. So, you know, if you go to office saying, well, I'm going to get rid of the elites, but you can't actually do that, the best you can do is replace them with another set of elites. You haven't actually solved the problem if the problem is defined as elite influence or elite control or something like that. That's the paradox. So that's why a demagogue, you know, can't be successful for the country.
Unless the demagogue came in and under the guise of destroying institutions, changed them to make them work better. I mean, that's the theoretical possibility.
Definitely, it's a theoretical possibility. And you could imagine someone like that. You know, you could imagine someone, you know, really, you know, shrewd. And, you know, probably there were people like that. I don't know. Maybe, you know, Napoleon was sort of like, well, Napoleon didn't really appeal to, he certainly wasn't purport to be a Democrat. But Napoleon was a demagogue who got into power, and then he put into place a pretty sophisticated bureaucracy. But, you know, he also created a police state, so that didn't work out so well for the French, as well as, you know, losing the Napoleonic Wars. But I think the contradiction here is that, you know, demagogues don't think that way. The way they, it's hard to know, you know, what they're secretly thinking, but they say to the world, you know, elite institutions are the problem, I'm going to get rid of them. And so if they come into power and then they turn around and start to construct, you know, in a kind of an overt way, a new set of elite institutions, people say, hey, you know, you're contradicting what you said before. And that's not a good way to maximize political support. I think what happens, like in the case of Jackson, is just that a kind of, you know, new elite forms in a kind of organic or decentralized way around the president, and then things move on from there.
So one question is why we don't see a demagogue as president between Jackson and Trump. I mean, you have a long account of that in-between period. You talk about the populist party in the late 19th century. You describe demagogues at different levels in the states with Huey Long, who went to the Senate, and McCarthy. You talk about near demagogues or people that had demagogic tendencies but weren't, like William Jennings Bryan. You consider both Roosevelts through the lens of the demagogue and explain why neither one's rose to the level of a demagogue. And also at the same time, you talk about from the beginning and increasingly so over time, how the institutions that the framers designed to prevent the demagogue from gaining power, one by one, went away. And there were a few that went away in the period just prior to Trump, but for the most part, that happened before Trump. So I guess one question is why the long period, given this constant threat and given the decline of the institutions designed to prevent the demagogue, why did it take so long for another one to come into power?
Part of the problem is that Jackson himself damaged the presidency, the prestige of the presidency, and the power of Washington, D.C. And the country in the years after Jackson began to move towards civil war. And it's kind of everything was swallowed up by that. If the South and the North become the, you know, the major political entities in a contest with each other, it's going to be hard for somebody to take power and, you know, rule the whole country. The closest you have to that is Lincoln, but, you know, Lincoln was the opposite of a demagogue, although he was very powerful and had kind of quasi-dictatorial military powers during the Civil War. But, I mean, the fact is that the national government was weakened and it wouldn't recover until the 20th century. I suppose you could have had, you know, a demagogue running a, you know, a weak national government. Now, that didn't happen. And part of it is probably luck. But I think a big part of it is that in the wake of Jackson, you have the modern party system developing. You know, first you have the Democrats and the Whigs. Ultimately, it becomes the Democrats and the Republicans. And these, in the party system, you have professional politicians and other elites, as I said before, journalists, editors, lawyers, people with money, all these guys kind of collectively select the candidate for the presidency, both for the Democrats and the Republicans. And these party elites were very powerful. They never had the interest in selecting a demagogue because, you know, what a demagogue does is destroy the existing political institutions. And so the party system is a kind of a cozy system. And before allowing ordinary people to vote, remember, under the definition of the demagogue appeals to the ordinary people, but the party leaders could ensure that doesn't happen by vetting the plausible presidential candidates and ensuring that the ones who prevail are not really demagogues, aren't demagogues in character, but are, you know, what they really were kind of colorless professional politicians who knew how to schmooze and more or less knew what they were doing and had worked long and hard to develop political support. And, you know, that was kind of the system that we have until the 60s and 70s. Theodore Roosevelt was an exceptional person who almost kind of broke out of it and certainly did have demagogic tendencies by the time, you know, he ran for office after he left the presidency in 1912 against Wilson. And he was, you know, a larger than life figure who appealed to ordinary people, but he lost that election. So that was that. And Franklin Roosevelt, you know, he certainly didn't run as a demagogue. He just ran as, you know, not being Hoover, the Biden strategy, I suppose. But once he was in office, you know, he might have thought, you know, I'm in office, we're in the middle of an economic crisis, I'm going to go after the rich people, or I'm going to go after Jews, or, you know, I'm going to go after whatever, foreigners, to kind of consolidate my popular support. But he did not do that. You know, I don't think that was in his character, but I also, at least it appears to have been the politically correct strategy as well. He was obviously a massively popular president, and he beat back the demagogues of the time, like Father Coughlin and Huey Long. So that, but he too was a creature of the party system. He had been a loyal Democrat from the beginning and worked his way up through his talents and his immense personal skills. Yeah. So why wasn't there a demagogue? You know, I think it's a lot contingency. A lot of it is just, you know, pure contingency. But the system that we had didn't tend toward creating demagogues because it was, you know, a powerful and successful elite-led system.
Right. So Huey Long is, admit to me, I didn't know that much about him. He's one of the most interesting characters in the book. He strikes me, tell me if this is wrong, as unlike the other demagogues, he seemed to have more political competence and more of a positive program. And it seems like he could have, if he gained national power, which you speculate he couldn't have before he was killed. He just seemed to me to have more self-discipline, more self-control, better political instincts, and a more positive thought-out program for sort of quote-unquote ordinary people. Is that a fair characterization of him compared to the other ones?
You know, I think I mostly agree with that. I'm not sure how carefully his program was thought out. I mean, at one level, his program was appealing. You know, his program was, let's help poor people. And it's a little, I think historians still debate how much he did help poor people, but, you know, he seemed to be sincere. He did build roads and libraries and schools and things like that in Louisiana. But, you know, as he starts targeting, you know, national politics, becomes a senator, you know, obviously wants to be president, he starts talking about sharing the wealth in a way that, you know, sounds a lot like Hugo Chavez. To take a more recent example, like, let's just redistribute a ton of money to poor people. And, you know, and he makes these arguments in quite vague terms, which aren't consistent with the economic realities. You know, there just wasn't that much wealth around. And his sort of, you know, program, it wasn't, it wasn't like a white paper from Brookings. It was something that sounded like it would be appealing to people. But he is attractive. I mean, I agree with you. You know, you can watch his speeches on YouTube. He seems like a very brilliant person, but incredibly cynical. I mean, really cynical, totally amoral. And, you know, Roosevelt respected him. I mean, did not approve of him, but called him one of the two most dangerous people in the United States. He is definitely a fascinating person. But, you know, I think Wong was the sort of person that the founders would have feared, like a brilliant person, the way Caesar was, a brilliant person who understood how to appeal to ordinary people, to appeal to their resentments, and who could kind of create a plausible sounding program for ordinary people by just saying, look, you know, the reason why you're poor is that the elites are corrupt and I'll get rid of them. And of course, the elites were corrupt in Louisiana, you know, and he did get rid of them. It didn't help in the long run anybody really, but you know, how can you argue with that? How can you argue with someone who says he wants to get rid of the corrupt elites when they in fact are very corrupt?
Support for today's Lawfare podcast comes from the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. As an attorney, you can help your community improve through service and the pursuit of justice. At Mitchell Hamlin, you can study the law in a way that fits your life. There are full-time and part-time options both on campus and online. The law school has an over 100-year tradition of a rigorous, practice-based approach to legal education that prepares students to add value in their communities. In addition to its JD program, Mitchell Hamlin offers legal education certifications in cybersecurity and privacy law, elder law, healthcare administration, and human resource compliance. In a time when so many law schools are switching to online platforms, Mitchell Hamlin has an established record of providing high-quality legal education in online, in-person, and blended forms. Learn more at mitchellhamlin.edu. That's mitchellhamlin.edu.
So you talk about, before we get to Trump, I have a couple of other questions. You talk in the book about how, this is my paraphrase, democracy is invariably needs elite institutions to work. Elite institutions necessarily generate resentment, which gives rise to the populist or the anti-elite impulse, which creates the conditions for a demagogue. Is that basically right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you talk about the big lie, and you say the big lie of the demagogue is the promise to eliminate institutional elites and replace them with the unmediated voice of the people as articulated by the leader itself. And that's clearly what Trump did. I think that's what Jackson did. But you also talk about another big lie, and you don't call it a big lie, but let me read it to you. It is also a feature of American public life that no one, or certainly no public or corporate official, may acknowledge that the elites are in control. That was an arresting sentence when I read it. I actually think it's kind of right, but why is that? What's going on there?
Well, because the ideology of the United States from the beginning is self-government, is, you know, ordinary people have influence over their political outcomes. And a part of that really is equality, that, you know, all people have the same influence. Everybody has one vote.
But so would you call that the big lie of American democracy?
Yeah, well, I guess that's a very good point. I think every country, you know, has an ideology, which is not true. and ours is that, right, that we can do without the elites. And I have been struck. I mean, I've done this myself, you know, say, oh, the elites believe this, or, you know, people are often attacking the liberal elites, or, you know, the reason why something is wrong is that the elites believe it. And, you know, in writing this book, I realized, well, yeah, people have been saying that for 200 years. We still have elites. All countries have elites. Like, you're not going to get rid of them. But, you know, the reason why people lapse into this type of argument, which is, you know, deep down a kind of simple-minded argument, is that the ideology of self-government and political equality is just so powerful that we're uncomfortable with this idea that there's always going to be a group of elites who have disproportionate political influence. So let me say then, the big lie, you know, so what the demagogue is doing is exploiting that, right?
Yeah.
That's why they're so powerful and dangerous.
Yeah. Because in effect, they're exposing that lie and pressing on it.
Right.
And it appeals to people. As you say, it appeals to you without you realizing. It appeals to me sometimes without me realizing it. So yeah. Before we get to Trump, can you just walk through all the ways in which the institutions, or the main ways that the institutions the framers set up to keep a demagogue out of the presidency, kind of dissipated over time?
Yeah, a brief sketch. You know, well, I think an important part is the collapse of the party system. Of course, the founders didn't set up the party system. The modern party system starts with Andrew Jackson. But you know, basically, what happened is the founders had this convoluted and complicated system of separation of powers and limited franchise and all that. That gets replaced by a more democratic system that's controlled by the parties, and then the parties begin to decline in the 1960s and the 1970s, as it's just basically the 60s is a kind of another small d democratic revolution where people say, look, you know, the party system led us into Vietnam. We don't trust it. And so the parties themselves had to democratize and give ordinary people more influence on the selection of the candidates. So the professional politicians who have an interest in keeping a demagogue out have less influence over the selection of candidates for the presidency.
Also through the Electoral College, with the change in how senators are.
Right, exactly. So the electoral college, that happens relatively quickly. The states decide that rather than let the electors exercise their judgment, which is what the founders expected, the states simply required the electors to vote the same as the popular vote in the state. So the electors were no longer a barrier against demagoguery. So, yeah, senators would then be popularly elected. And the presidency also became so much more powerful and so much more a focus of politics that it has become less and less realistic to expect Congress and the courts to check the president. Although, of course, they still do to some extent. Other developments that were important, the rise of the national media and now social media, which allowed people to, again, sort of know more what's going on and insist more on having influence over political outcomes. And in turn, though, they gave tools to the aspiring demagogue or the actual demagogue to appeal over the institutions directly to ordinary people, an approach that Teddy Roosevelt had kind of pioneered. So those are what I think of as the main developments that eroded the sort of institutional limits on demagoguery that had begun with the founders.
Okay, which brings us to Trump. So why don't you give the basic account for why you think? I mean, you think that the category of demagogue explains why Trump won, but I have some questions about that. Why don't you go ahead and lay it out?
Right. I mean, I think it played a big role. Trump won for many reasons. I think once he won the campaign for the Republican nomination, his demagoguery didn't particularly help him. I think, you know, at that point, Republicans voted for him, and then because of the electoral college system and various other things, he squeaked in. The real role of demagoguery was in the primary campaign, when Trump got the support of basically most Republican voters, or more support than any of the other candidates did. And there's nothing inevitable about Trump, but the conditions were ripe for a demagogue. The Republican establishment had done a really bad job, you know, running the country. Under Bush, the country entered into this ruinous war with Iraq, which was really just a war of choice. And then the financial crisis. I don't think the financial crisis was entirely the fault of the Republicans, and certainly not Bush. It's just he inherited the system we had. But certainly people were very unhappy by 2016, with the lingering effects of an enormous recession, financial crisis, military defeat, and so on. And so, you know, when the elites in power have done a bad job, that's the chance for the demagogue to come in and say, the elites are corrupt. That's why we're here.
Yes, I agree. But the remarkable thing is, my question is going to be at the end of this wind-up, why did it take a demagogue to do it? Because as you point out, in the book, what Trump really did was press on issues that were a consensus among elites in both parties. You say 2016 was propitious for an outsider because policy supported by both parties, financial deregulation, bailouts, immigration compromise, the Iraq war, were unpopular. And Trump kind of put all those issues on the agenda and in a way that kind of defied the elite consensus in both parties and touched on something in the country. So I guess my question is, and I don't know, it's a mystery to me how he was able to do that, but it seems to me he did do that. Why did it take a demagogue to do that? Why couldn't there have been a third party or someone in another party, a non-elite inside the party that didn't have the less attractive qualities, Trump's unattractive, many unattractive qualities? Why did it take, was there something special about a demagogue that's able to do that, to have insight into that problem? Was it something about, I don't understand why a demagogue had to address the problem of an elite consensus that wasn't conserving the public interest.
Well, there certainly were people who had, you know, made these arguments. Bernie Sanders had made the argument, you know, I know some people think he's a demagogue or was, I don't, but, or, you know, Ross Perot, Pat Buchanan, I mean, all kinds of prominent people and politicians had brought up, you know, dissatisfaction with immigration and foreign trade long before Trump did. So, you know, these ideas were out there and people have been making these arguments. But the difference between an ordinary politician or a responsible politician and Trump is that the ordinary politician would, you know, will say, OK, you know, there's too much immigration, so let's reduce it. And or there's too much foreign trade, and let's reduce it. Or the bailouts are bad, let's put in place laws to prevent them from happening again. What the demagogue does is he takes the next step. He says not only were there mistakes, that did people make mistakes, but they made mistakes because they are corrupt and self-interested. And the party system itself, Republicans and Democrats together, you know, put into place policies that enrich them at the expense of ordinary people. What we have to do is get rid of them. Now, that type of argument, that's what distinguishes Trump. Now, that type of argument isn't always going to win. You know, it took Trump's personal qualities and, you know, all kinds of things. You know, people were angry, and so were more receptive to that type of argument. But I don't think it was that Trump, you know, realized that these policies mattered more to people than other politicians did. Maybe he did to a little bit to some extent. But I'm not even sure that getting rid of, you know, reducing immigration or reducing illegal immigration, people have been making that argument before. Politicians have been worried and talked about it before. So what was really going on, it was not just the attack on the elites, it was the viciousness, you know, the anger, the appeal to resentments, you could say, Ross Perot or Pat Buchanan could say, there's too much illegal immigration or there's too much immigration, without saying, well, you know, that's because there's the elites are corrupt and they do better from immigration while ordinary people lose their jobs. So Trump just went farther because he's basically shameless and he just said what he thought would appeal to people. So he exaggerated the source of these problems, exaggerated his ability to solve them.
But the amazing thing to me is, you're right, on immigration, he was harsh and verged on being racist and said, build the wall. And he went way beyond the rhetoric of the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. On the war stuff, even though he was contradictory, he was very critical of Bush and McCain, who were basically revered in the party until then. He pushed the envelope much, much further in these criticisms, and he wasn't nice about it, as you say. But the amazing thing was, and he didn't win the popular vote, but that had such broad appeal. It was the extremeness, I think, in part, that gave his arguments, which, as you say, in some form have been made by others before. It was the extremeness and even the rudeness and the norm breaking, which I think is also seen as an attractive anti-elite quality.
Right, because it separated him from the elites, right? So
yeah.
I mean, if he says, you know, all these Republicans are, you know, they're idiots and they're evil, you know, I mean, there's a kind of a simple, powerful logic to this. He's basically saying to ordinary people, I don't care about them. Like, I don't care if they like me. I don't care if they, you know, aren't willing to hire me if I lose this election in their corporations or put me in cushy think tank jobs. Like, I don't need them. I reject them. That gave him credibility. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that ordinary professional politicians can't afford to do. You know, they have to remain in good graces with the party leaders so that they have some future chance at an elected office or an appointment or, you know, something. And so, you know, part of the reason why Trump was able to do this was he was independently wealthy. Like, you know, the demagogues of ancient Greece and ancient Rome were also enormously wealthy and therefore not dependent on the, you know, the elite system. But I do think all that stuff worked together. I mean, if you get angry at somebody, you're going to alienate that person. And so you're visibly making clear to the world that you don't need that person and that you're not controlled by that person. And in fact, you're on the side of the people.
Yeah, it seems to me that was a credible way of establishing his anti-elitist credentials. I mean, he was just a bulldozer through all of the elite positions, and including all of the elite niceties.
Yeah, including just like Huey Long and McCarthy and Andrew Jackson. You know, that's what distinguishes these people from other politicians who may have had offensive policies or bad policies, but were not demagogues.
So let me ask you just a couple more questions. So I think I read this book as you being on the side of, ultimately on the side of elite institutions as necessary. You don't actually, you kind of, you say you're not taking this position, but I think you are taking this position, that you're kind of on the side of elite institutions. You think elite institutions are necessary for democracy to work. You think Trump's attack on institutions needs to be repudiated. But are you really happy with the state of American institutions? I mean, do you think, and that's the first part of the question. The second part is, do you think, and it's related, are the conditions now set for more demagogues going forward, or is Trump just an accident, or can you tell?
Right. And to be clear, I do think that maybe I wasn't as clear in the book as I should be, but I do think that elite institutions are essential to any functioning democracy.
No, you did say that. You did say that. No, you made that very clear. There was just some point in the book which you said, it doesn't matter, which you said something like you weren't going to be judging the institutions or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. Well, you know, academic hedging, but
great.
So I'm not happy with American institutions, definitely. Like, you know, there are all kinds of problems with American institutions, but the solution is not to have a revolution, sweep them away, elect somebody who will become a dictator. You have to reform them. There's really, you know, no alternative. So a lot of people aren't happy with the Supreme Court. People propose ways of reforming it. Maybe they'll happen, maybe they won't, you know. You know this debate. I mean, it's old and it's uninspiring, but it's all we have.
Yeah, I agree. I'm about to contribute to it.
Yeah, as have I. Right? Yeah. Can we fix the Electoral College? You know, can we divide California into two states? I mean, there are all kinds of, can we, you know, control campaign finance? That's just how ordinary politics works. You know, we acknowledge that there are problems. Let's excessive financial deregulation prior to 2008, or the president has too much control over the use of military force and that led to Iraq. Maybe we think that, and then we think of ways of, you know, preventing that from happening again through institutional reform. So I'm not complacent about America's institutions. You know, they're better than that of most countries, but they're definitely not great. And they're definitely worse than the institutions of many, many countries, many liberal democracies. You know, so and then going forward, okay, are we going to have another demagogue? So one thing that makes me optimistic is that to a kind of an amazing extent, Trump has no imitators. You know, there's some, there's some people, some, you know, mediocre politicians who are running maybe for the Senate or the House or state legislators who imitate Trump, but he really does. There's really no really prominent politician who tries to be like Trump, who, you know, tweets, you know, constant lies and insults and ridiculous things. Like, nobody, and I just find this both amazing and comforting. You know, you'd think that the guy who won the presidency against all odds, maybe he'll be reelected. Other aspiring presidents, other ambitious politicians would say, well, you know, he's obviously figured something out. I'm going to try to be like him. but they haven't. And I think that, you know, they realize that, or at least they believe that this strategy of demagoguery, it's not really a very good strategy for achieving political power. I mean, it worked for Trump in special circumstances, but it's unlikely to work in, you know, 2020 or 2024, unless we have some new catastrophe, right?
Right.
So if we do have like a new catastrophe, definitely expect more people to try to obtain power through demagogic means.
Yeah. So on that, let me just give a slightly different take on why people don't follow Trump. I mean, I think a lot of his power comes from his personality disorders. I mean, his utter shamelessness is a source of enormous power. And most human beings don't have that. They actually have self-constraints and a conscience and the like. His inability, I truly think it's an inability to tell reality from fiction or lies, is in many ways a source of power that I think other human beings have a hard time replicating. But the question is, and this is something I was puzzled about throughout the book, why can't you have someone sort of committed to demagogic ends and who attacks institutions and who is committed to attacking institutions and appealing to the people over the institutions and identifying himself or herself over and against those institutions, but who does so in a more subtle way, with better manners, seeming to work within the institutions, not committing all of the many, many, many self-defeating mistakes Trump has done? I mean, why isn't that the next round of this? Is that possible, or do the bad manners go and all the other stuff, do they go hand in hand with the demagogue's playbook?
Well, I think it's possible in a general sense. I mean, what you're talking about is basically a Machiavellian politician who, you know, skillfully pushes the levers of power, you know, cleverly makes allies, you know, says the right things to the right people, and eventually becomes very powerful. I think in the United States, that's unlikely because power is so diffused. And, you know, at least traditionally, if you're going to become presidency, if you're going to become the president, you have to be vetted and tested over and over again over decades, and people will eventually figure out that you're not to be trusted. I mean, this is not to say that some very ingenious, brilliant person couldn't do this, but that is a path to power. It just doesn't seem that plausible in the United States. It's the sort of thing that happens, for example, in authoritarian regimes, you know, someone like Putin, where you don't have to, you know, power is just not as diffuse. You don't have to deal with so many different people and institutions and so on. So, of course, that could happen. But I do think, you know, take the better manners part, you know, as we were talking about before, the demagogue is really like an incredible gambler. You know, the demagogue is going for broke. The demagogue is showing the people that he's on their side by cutting his ties with the establishment. So, you know, he either wins or loses. And that is, you know, that's the kind of risk that ordinary politicians don't want to take most of the time. You know, certainly professional politicians who don't have some independent source of wealth and so on and so forth. So certainly, you know, no political system is possible and somebody, the Machiavellian type of person, could come to power. But you know, that's not what the book's about. And I, you know, I can't really think in American history a president who's really been like that.
Maybe Nixon.
Nixon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nixon, Roosevelt.
And Nixon had a bit of a demagogue in him also. Nixon was a very complicated person and very shrewd. But yeah, maybe Nixon's the best. Maybe Lyndon Johnson is a good case.
So, Eric, my last question is about Eric Posner's view of the presidency circa 2020. You started off the book by saying, near the beginning, you say something is wrong with the presidency, but what exactly? And you're really talking about other people's criticism to the presidency. You end the book in the last paragraph by talking, the last sentence of the book says, we need to see Trump as a political monstrosity who should be repudiated by the body politic so that politicians who eye the presidency in the future will be deterred from using Trump's ascendance as a model. You also suggest, you say it's tempting to argue that to prevent another demagogue from taking the presidency and causing even worse damage than Trump, maybe we need constitutional reform. But then you drop a footnote, the last footnote of the book, where you say that's not your view. your view is that we need a powerful presidency to solve the problems in the American constitutional system. That's a view I share. So I'm just wondering how all these things fit together. I mean, what and how has Trump, if at all, affected your view of the American presidency, which you think needs to be strong?
So you read the footnotes.
Well, I read that footnote because I was surprised. I mean, yeah. I was surprised by the time of the text. I think it's the only footnote I read.
Right. So I continue to think that, you know, in the American system, a powerful president is both inevitable and necessary to, you know, these incredibly serious challenges. And then, of course, you know, as the founders themselves understood, if you have a powerful president, that person might abuse his power. So, you know, what do you do about it? And, you know, at one point I thought in the book I could talk about possible constitutional reforms, including, you know, rules that would limit the type of person who could become a president. You know, this was actually part of the Roman system, the kind of informal constitutional rule, which is that you didn't become the top guy, the consul, unless you had had previous offices where you had proven yourself. And we could imagine something like that in the United States. You can't become president unless you've previously been a governor or senator or something like that. You know, you can. It's easy to think of constitutional reforms with Trump in mind that might prevent another demagogue from becoming a president. Or you could, or another thought, another, a lot of people have argued this, that, you know, they've encouraged the parties to try to bring back the old system of vetting, because that seemed to have done a good job of preventing a demagogue from becoming a president. But, you know, that stuff seemed a little bit trite, actually, to me. There's room for that type of argument. But I think in the end, you know, the real problem with Trump was just that he got a lot of political support, that a lot of people thought he would be a good president. Maybe not the majority, but, you know, enough. And as long as people are roped in by someone like Trump, I don't think any amount of institutional reform is going to, you know, is going to be enough. In fact, as we see throughout American history, what's more likely is that ordinary people who want a demagogue in power will oppose institutional reforms or structures that prevent their guy from getting into power. So what I just like is for people to, you know, think that that Trump is a bad guy, you know, that type of person, what Trump did to get power is unacceptable, and that they shouldn't vote for someone like that. Now, I don't think that's totally unrealistic. I mean, the fact is that Trump has done a terrible job and people are losing confidence in him. And I think people can see easily that some things that might seem superficially attractive, like his repudiation of the establishment, have not worked out that well for the American public. So, you know, that's where I am. The just to answer your final question, you know, an easy thing to say is that we need to introduce more constraints on the president. I know you're a big fan of inspectors general, which, of course, Trump is dismantling, right? But, you know,
I don't think he's dismantling them, but go ahead.
Yeah, you're right. It's complicated. So anyway, but, you could imagine a stronger system of inspectors general that restrain the president and so on and so forth. And, you know, I'm more open to that now after Trump than I was before. So I do think I underestimated in my earlier work the risks that someone like Trump could become president. I really think there's been no one like him, with the complicated exception of Andrew Jackson. So those types of proposals to constrain the presidency seem more reasonable to me now than before. But I do think people have to think carefully about the consequences of greater constraints on the presidency, which is that the office becomes too weak to protect Americans from all of the risks and dangers that are evident today.
We're going to find out. Eric, thank you very, very much. That was great.
Thanks, Jack. I had a good time.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to lawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this week was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.